All right. Hello and welcome to Mobility Podcast. This is Greg Rogers with a actually some news. I will soon be joining the team at Nuro after a fantastic couple of years with Securing America's Future Energy. Excited to discuss more on that, but for right now, in the middle of an interesting couple weeks of reading, writing, and recording some great episodes with my co-hosts. But first, I guess we'll jump in and introduce my co-hosts.
Pete Gould with Catapult Policy Strategies.
And Greg Rodriguez, as always, views are our own.
Excellent. And as many of you know, the Mobility Podcast's focus in the past few months has been on how we build it back. And build it better after COVID-19 and a lot of the conversations that have been happening in 2020. You know, there are a lot of negative externalities in our transportation sector, and that's really become abundantly clear in the past few months. And it's given us the opportunity to take a sober look at how we design our streets, what we design them for, and also who we design them for. And so for that reason, I'm really excited to welcome our guest today, Richard Ezeke. He is the Senior Policy Associate at the Urban Institute. Richard, welcome. I'll turn over to you to talk about your background and how you got into the transportation space.
Great. Thank you for that, Greg. And also, I'm glad to see both Greg Rodriguez and Pete Gould, who have, I worked with before on autonomous vehicle policy and just thought and brainstorming. So it's great to have you meet with you guys again, and again, glad to be on the podcast. I currently work at the Urban Institute as a Senior Policy Associate, as Greg mentioned. And in that role, I am managing a $1.5 million research program that's supported by the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth, which is the company's philanthropic arm, called Accelerating Innovation for Inclusion. And the main focus of this work is to look at how technology and other innovative other innovations are helping to promote equity in cities, specifically regarding access to services and among other things. And so I deal with project management in terms of managing budgets and workflows, things like that. But also I do some writing, reports and blogs, also proposal development and bringing in more funds to support this work. And as I mentioned, generally, you know, this idea of like, what does it mean for cities to become innovative, but also how to do it in an equitable and inclusive way. And so over the last year, we've focused on a number of different topics, such as transportation, which we'll go into more in this podcast. Also looking at the SNAP benefits and EBT program, tackling the digital divide, and also opportunity zones and other land use policies. And again, really the focus on technology, innovation, and you know, how these programs are going to change moving forward. So that's what I've been doing for the last year. Before Urban, I was at the Union Concerned Scientist and doing a 2-year fellowship where I looked at the equity impacts of self-driving cars, specifically within the DC area, and worked with a really great team at UCS, looking at these impacts, particularly looking at when you transition to a single occupancy car paradigm, which kind of dominates the United States, to a pooling or multiple passenger rides, and then also looking at the impact of expanding transit along with a fleet of vehicles in the area that are fully autonomous. So basically assuming 100% autonomy and how that affects congestion, transit ridership, and emissions. So did that for the past 2 years. And actually that's kind of how I got introduced to the team here on the podcast. And then before that, I was at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, looking at the impact, doing another fellowship, looking at the impacts on transportation and accessibility, particularly for the African-American community. So mostly looking at policy, looking at doing some analyses on transportation bills, the current transportation infrastructure, and its impact, both positive and negative, on the Black experience. And so I'm originally a chemical engineer by training. I kind of got into transportation kind of by happenstance. You know, before the foundation work, I was doing some patent application, analysis, particularly with oil and natural gas drilling chemical formulas and broader other broader chemical applications that didn't suit me for in terms of my career. And the fellowship came up in a time where I was doing a lot of work in the environmental space, consulting here and there. This is around 2014. And then the foundation, as I mentioned, you know, reached out to me with because they were interested in looking at my using my expertise to think about transportation and how it affects sustainability, environmental justice, particularly with the Black community. And that's kind of how I've been able to get my fit into the transportation space. And in the last 5 years, I just kind of expanded into that. And so getting more involved in aspects related to public transportation, new mobility, such as my micro mobility, such as scooters, dockless bikes, self-driving cars, of course, microtransit, and just kind of looking at, you know, again, how these new technologies affect the way we move from point A to point B. And I think most importantly is how can we, these technologies help promote and develop a more equitable transportation system that provides access to all people, no matter where they are, where they live, what they look like, how much they make, that everybody has a chance to get to where they need to go safely, efficiently, and cost effectively. That's my focus.
Awesome. And you know, we're really excited to have you on especially at this time where, you know, mm-hmm. between COVID-19, between the renewed conversations around race in the United States and how this ties into really everything. And in transportation in particular, you know, there's so many things that I think that we've, the transportation sector has overlooked for a long time. And so excited to dig into these issues with you and hear some of your insights. And I suppose one place to start is really on, you know, most recently you had this piece in early May. It was called 4 Ways to Equitably Manage Public Transit Options in a Crisis. And it dealt with a lot of these hard questions that transit agencies are dealing with as they were trying to balance, you know, access to transportation, keeping everyone safe, preventing spread of the disease, and
zero budget.
Yeah, with zero budget, actually going deeper into the red, right?
Yeah.
And we'd like to hear, you know, what your thoughts are now on how trans agencies respond, and now that we're a few months into this.
Yeah, that's a great question, and you know, as it was aptly mentioned, these agencies are facing hard times. I mean, you know, over the last few months, there have been estimates agencies have lost ridership as much as 95%. I know in DC, that, you know, at the peak of the pandemic, maybe it was April or May, I mean, ridership numbers had dropped almost 95% because the agency was, closing the in cars to promote social distancing and cutting up bus routes and reducing trains and boarding from the back of the bus instead of the front, where people actually pay fares. So basically, you know, riding the bus was of no cost to riders, which of course hit their bottom lines. And of course, the disinfecting of all their vehicles was another added expense. And in addition to the ridership drop, it just has blown a big hole in a lot of these agencies' budgets. And it's unfortunate because a lot of these agencies were starting to bounce back, you know, and bring back ridership as they were, you know, slowly building their infrastructure back up to a state of good repair or, you know, working order. And now they got hit with the coronavirus and it's just kind of turned things upside down. So because of that, you know, they've had to adjust and consider how can we get back to some sort of normal level of operation or some level of operation, definitely not where they are now, and keep riders safe. You know, their initial ask, of course, was to get money from the CARES Act, which they were able to get to the tune of about $25 billion, which were distributed to the different public transit agencies across the country and provided a kind of a lifeline for the first few months of the pandemic to allow them to operate with the large ridership. But now, as they know that funding is kind of winding down, there have been some subsequent relief bills that, you know, have provided a little bit of funding, but not enough for them to continue. So they have to think about how to get back in to some sort of working order. And the agencies are, you know, being innovative in trying to do this. And one agency that I want to point out, of course, is the country's largest system, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority of New York. And so New York, what they did is they developed a 13-point plan that would mandate safe operation of transit while keeping people safe, encouraging social distancing, wear masks and things like that. So, for example, as we know, New York City's subway system and bus system is 24 hours. The first thing they did was to cut that to 20 hours. Basically, they closed at 1 a.m. and they disinfected buses and trains between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. Now they're kind of now going back to full 24-hour subway service. I think they started that in June the 8th, but they're still shutting them down on 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. So they're kind of having that time to disinfect trains and buses. And they're looking at new ways to kind of disinfect these trains and buses, such as ultraviolet disinfecting. You know, right now they're just using, of course, EPA mandated cleaners to do so, but they're looking at some ways to really do that in time, you know, while people are riding. They are planning to require face mask for all riders to help them protect them for the coronavirus. And actually, other systems around the world have mandated face mask wearing, and their MTA is actually looking to saying that, you know, if you don't wear a face mask, they can actually prevent you from riding on the train or bus. So again, it's really trying to standardize this idea of, you know, if you want to get anywhere to be the public transit, you have to wear a face mask. They are looking at, you know, again, I mentioned other new technologies they're putting in, such as using thermal scans for large groups to see where people may have elevated temperatures and therefore potential to be positive for the coronavirus. They want to measure, again, crowds and find sensors to where people are located. And then also they're looking at extra reservations. So if you want to take a bus, you have to reserve time so they can control how many people get on a bus or on a train to try to maintain that 6-foot social distancing. That's what MTA, I think, is doing. And again, as they go through kind of the different phases, very similar to what a lot of the state governments are doing, every time they get to kind of a threshold of positive cases below level, they open up a little bit more. So kind of what MTA is doing, again, is a lot of what you're seeing the agencies across the world are doing. And I think you're going to see those kind of those same points and markers be adopted by the other agencies across the country as well. So I think the MTA, again, has a plan. A lot of agencies have a plan as they get to some certain thresholds of cases, they start to open up more of their trains, more of their buses. You know, Metro just made an announcement here in DC that they're going to open up 15 stations that they closed down. So I think really the idea is, hey, let's have a plan. Let's track the number of cases. If it starts to go down, let's open up in phases slowly but surely. Incorporate these mask wearing, social distancing requirements, frequent disinfecting of trains and buses, and encourage people to try to get back, knowing that the agencies are trying to do whatever they can to keep people safe. So you're starting to see some, you know, good work from the MTA and other agencies to make that happen.
That's a great recap. As we've seen, everyone is scrambling, and I'm curious. You know, my big fear, and we've talked about it on the show a few times, is that it has been going on and will go on for some more time, that it's long enough that you could have real, you know, habit changes and for the worse, you know, where you create people who, if they're avoiding transit, they're going, you know, because especially in the early days when they're, you know, even the transit agencies are saying, hey, right now, this is not a great idea. But even, you know, as we're reopening, how do we ensure that we're not that, like, what are alternatives to provide a kind of short to medium ish term, like alternative that allows people to get back into that state of where transit is kind of reinvigorating and it's a ridership gains and all that?
Yeah, and especially for people who are still relying on these services, right? I mean, how do we ensure that they're still continuing to be served? I mean, there are all kinds of stories about how much trouble people had in accessing transportation during mm-hmm. this period.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good question, and it's a challenge because, you know, kind of going back to new normal where you know, you're going to have crowded trains and crowded buses, you know, especially if this pandemic lasts for months or even years, as some epidemiologists have suggested, you know, will keep people away from the system most likely. Now, there's been some studies recently that have shown that, you know, public transit isn't the big super spreader of COVID-19 as previously feared. But, you know, it is all about perception. And if people feel like, you know, being in closed spaces is going to do that, then you're going to see them step back. And of course, as Pete alluded to, the solution that the alternative that we don't want to get to is increased driving. And there's also been some studies, especially one that I think got some traction from Vanderbilt University that came out last week that said that could potentially be in some of our larger cities, you know, magnitudes of order increase in congestion. And of course, that is antithetical to our climate goals, our congestion goals for like big cities. You know, it's really going to move us backwards. So I think what you have to see again is one, looking at some potential alternatives to moving public transportation. I think you're seeing a lot of integration with new mobility and public transit. So this idea of potentially, you know, having scooters and dockless bikes fill the first mile, last mile, and connecting people to either connect people to transit or even replacing their short trips that people may have taken via public transit. You know, and I think there's a potential for, if you see that trend and that kind of building up, you may see transit agencies look to partner with these companies or even publicly fund via subsidy, you know, these companies. There's been some talk about that in cities like Denver and Seattle about that. I mean, you know, right now the scooter companies are being hit hard, but there has been some evidence, especially in cities overseas, that people are taking bikes or are biking more. They're taking scooters more, especially in cities that are doing this open street policy where they're closing streets off to cars to give more room and space. You're seeing them take those modes more. So there's a potential option for kind of a transition from public transit and even car ridership to these scooters and dockless bikes for short trips. And I think where you're talking about, you know, the impact on people who rely on transit, you know, I would say that the number one option that is potentially is getting interest is the idea of microtransit. Looking at, you know, small vehicles that run along the typical bus routes that can take people from one point to another, again, very short trips, but also in much smaller and much less populated vehicles. I think one company that I've kind of followed really closely, who is very big into microtransit, is VIA. And they have one thing that they did is that they employed a microtransit survey in Sacramento, and they did a survey with their residents saying, like, you know, would you have taken Uber or Lyft or Drive if you didn't have this? And they had to 49% of them, if they didn't have microtransit, would have used Uber or Lyft, and 31% would have used their personal vehicles, right? They also did a survey where riders in Tel Aviv and United Kingdom, they use public transit and shared microtransit 2/3 of the time compared to driving 1/3 of the time. So I think what transit agencies can need to look at is how do we see ourselves changing over the next 5 to 10 years, as you know, the pandemic will eventually go away, but the change in behaviors are not. And of course, there could always be another pandemic, you know, another virus that could, you know, spread like wildfire, like the COVID-19 is now. And so they have to think about, okay, how can we maintain our, how can we build back our ridership, knowing that, you know, buses and trains may not be, you know, the ways that people go to. Now, of course, they may have to continue thinking about how to focus specific routes that service the ridership that people that are as required or feel that or transit that is essential to them. So I think they have to look at that as well. Like, where do we maintain our bus routes to, again, serve our essential workers? But at the same time, how can we incorporate, you know, micro-mobility and micro-transit and incorporate that into a system that, you know, feeds into our networks or, you know, replaces their short trips so people aren't driving, you know, single occupancy, you know, for short trips and contributing to, you know, congestion and climate issues. So I think you're seeing a lot of discussions related to those two new ways of intersecting with the public transit system. And I'm curious to see, like, over the next year or two, 5 years, how public transit as a whole changes because of those new modes.
I think that's all really interesting. And I'm kind of going to throw this conversation for a tangent, just starting to think about, okay, so why are we worried about congestion? I mean, and this goes to the human behavior element. If people want to get in their cars and drive around and sit in traffic, let's let them do that. And again, I'm just playing devil's advocate here. Mm-hmm. And if they're sitting in traffic, then how do we educate them around the values of transit? It's kind of, how do we use this rather than worrying about all the what ifs, kind of let things happen and then refocus on the system itself and the way it evolves and modernizes. And I think you did a good job of summarizing all the opportunities around flexibility, mm-hmm. adaptability, on-demand systems. Even when you brought up the conversation around a reservation system, I mean, we know that, you know, one of the downfalls of paratransit is that a lot of times someone does have to reserve a ride 24 hours in advance.
Right.
On the other hand, maybe that's a good thing right now because, you know, if I can think about, okay, so tomorrow morning, if I think about, oh gosh, my commute is going to be so much congestion, then I can do, like you said, like get a ticket for the transit agency. And then if there's a certain amount of tickets sold, then it causes them to cause the city to prioritize a bus lane or put that into effect. It's kind of thinking of the system more holistically with thinking about transit, thinking about economic activity through employers, and then also thinking about housing and where mm-hmm. the areas are that are lacking in transportation, you know, options that a lot of us take for granted. I mean, it goes back to the question. I think, Pete, the way you were phrasing it, and then, you know, Greg Rogers kind of came in and said, I mean, there are people that don't have a choice and that have to take transit. And so, you know, how do we think about the opportunities to fix the system for those people? And if people want to drive and sit in congestion, have at it.
I mean, I'll push back on that. I my concern is that given the situation, people make like purchase decisions, like going out and purchasing a car then locks you into that, you know, it does influence your willingness and ability, not so much ability, but really your willingness and the likelihood that you will get on transit. And so, yes, have at it, but, you know, but at the same time, that's kind of like, sure, I don't, you know, drive a giant SUV and do, live out in the, if that's your life. But it's like, no, but there are, you know, to be able to affect change on things, it's not really about congestion, because I'm with you. I don't, if you want to, if you're sitting in traffic, that's a choice. But to be able to have the long-term, particularly environmental benefits of and just land use and everything that comes with it, of being able to have a thriving transit system so that it is not just a system that serves people who don't have another choice. Because when the system gets to that, it then becomes a system that doesn't get as well funded. It becomes seen as like a social service as opposed to a like community, you know, mobility option, mm-hmm. Like by apparently, you know, or unfortunately by kind of the powers that be and in almost every place, you know, even in DC where we don't have a, you know, the kind of state legislature Albany problem that you see with New York, we're still a regional, you know, it's a regional thing. And so when it gets seen as, oh, that's just for people who don't have another option, it becomes kind of a vicious cycle of that this is not something that is to be, you know, prioritized, invested in, and improved. And so I think there's a lot of reasons that, you know, sure, if you want to go sit in traffic, that's your decision. You know, I kind of think about that when it's like, oh, I want to live way out and I'll just commute in and drive. And then to complain to me about traffic, it's like, I don't really have that much sympathy for you. But I do think that if the situation is driven by, you know, health fears of drive of, you know, or alterations that are necessary because the system is on reduced service, and people who would prefer to have used transit, but to do this long enough are making alternative decisions, that just, you know, I think the proposition you're putting there is like, then we can educate them. Like, that's what we've been doing for decades. And like, it's a hard process. And so it just feels like we're taking four steps back if there's a massive, you know, rush to purchase their own vehicles and to kind of alter mobility habits for the worse. It just feels like we're taking a lot of steps back to then have to do the slow grind of habit changing.
Yeah. I mean, that's fair. Although everything you're talking about is already happening. I mean, you look in DC, the number of people with, you know, new license plates that are unregistered is very concerning to me, seeing it.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's happening across the country. So I guess my point is it seems like it's too late.
We talked about this on the last show. We were like, it's really important that we do stuff now so that this doesn't happen. And now, and you know, that was a month or two ago. And now is the part when we're on, you know, coming out of our caves in a lot of places and mm-hmm. being able to go back out, and you're seeing exactly a lot of the bad stuff happen. I mean, traffic, you know, anecdotally, and also, you know, a lot of, you know, Avery at Inrix and a lot of other folks are showing just, yep, traffic's right back to just a little bit below, and in some places higher than where it was before. And as with everything COVID, we had a multi-week or even multi-month heads up watching it happen abroad, and then we did nothing and then are shocked that, oh my gosh, it's happening here mm-hmm. too.
Right. Well, I guess my question, you know, so yeah, so the reason for posing that question is kind of to ask Richard, where are the opportunities to reframe the conversation and to really use, you know, the inequities we're seeing come into full focus around transportation, the racial injustice issues that are coming into focus? I mean, we're debating a surface transportation bill right now.
Right.
You know, how can we refocus the conversation? I agree with you, Pete, all those potential negative externalities of everybody driving alone are there, but people don't seem to be listening to them. So I guess for Richard, do you see an opportunity here to finally get some momentum around that discussion? And are there any incentives that you're thinking about in your work to maybe get people out of cars and into transit? Assume, let's, you know, put COVID-19 fears aside.
And it's not just transit. I just want to throw in, it's not just transit. It's like literally anything but cars. I do think that we are seeing the bike boom too, and we can touch on that as well. But it's not just to get them into transit; it's just to get them out of cars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know, we are talking about equity here, so there are a lot of people that can't ride bikes and scooters. So I really want to focus in on the equity issue too.
Okay. Yeah, that's a big question. Reimagining transit. Like places, basically, where we're talking about. And I think to that, I would say that, you know, we talk about the environmental piece and how that's important. We know transportation is the largest generator of greenhouse gas emissions. We know that the recent reports have shown that we don't have a lot of time to, you know, really tackle these emissions before they get to a catastrophic level. And we're already seeing, you know, issues across the world with the zombie fires in Siberia and a likely going to be hotter than, you know, a record hot summer, you know, this and across the United States and Canada this upcoming summer. It's really thinking about externally looking outside of you as a transportation user and thinking about the bigger picture. I think when you bring these issues to the forefront in terms of, racial injustice and how transportation and placemaking over the years has exacerbated that, engaging the people who are the decision makers, in terms of, you know, where infrastructure is built, how its efficacy is measured, and where people build new developments, and trying to minimizing the whole idea of sprawl, again, and refocusing on still like infill and city development in a post-pandemic environment. You know, it's going to take, you know, really broad, really innovative thinking, and you know, looking outside the box to figure out how we don't build upon the art. We're already seeing this bounce back in congestion. No, we need to find ways to you know, look at how we work. You know, there's been discussions, preliminary discussions from companies about, you know, people working from home maybe 3 times a week and then coming into the office 2 times and staggering, you know, office workers, you know, every few days to keep down the number of people in a building. We have to think about and able to kind of incorporate all those as well. It's kind of, again, reimagining how we get to place, how we commute, with how we connect with our workplaces, how we connect with where we currently live, and how that needs to change over, you know, the near term. But yeah, the other from the equity standpoint as well. Again, it's we definitely want to avoid, you know, what P says, this idea that transit becomes a social service and therefore doesn't get funded. We have to continue to express and show people how public transit, especially in some of our urban centers, actually contributes to economic mobility, economic development, you know, environmental benefits, time benefits in terms of people being able to get access to, you know, destinations more quickly when they're not sitting in traffic. You know, of course, more cars may mean more, you know, more maintenance on roads, which again is supported by gas taxes, which, you know, that means even now agencies are, you know, judgment agencies are struggling to fulfill their budgets, and they have to put in more money to support roads if there are more cars. So kind of thinking about some of the consequences of, you know, increased driving. So I think if you can kind of incorporate some of the negative externalities of increased congestion and driving, and then tout the benefits of a robust public transit and alternative transportation system that as P alluded to, should involve all people, no matter where they go, and how everybody is a contributor to the economy, then I think you can reimagine, you can kind of shift the conversation away from a public transit is a barrier, it's bad, it's spreading your virus and nobody's going to take it, to this is why too much driving is dangerous to our society, and that public transit and other modes, non-car modes, are still a very key integral part of how we move around and how the economy is tied to having a robust alternative system. So I think just reframing the conversation, kind of highlighting the pitfalls and the benefits of kind of going to having a more equitable, more accessible, more frequent transportation system can help benefit all people. So, you know, there's a lot to unpack in that, yeah. A lot to unpack in how to plan that and how the conversations sound like are still kind of up in the air. I definitely will say that to close this question out, involving, you know, with, as you mentioned, with the how transportation and land use planning over the last, you know, 6-7 decades have kind of contributed to racial discrimination and racial injustice, and you know, we all know the history of highways being built through Black neighborhoods. We all know, you know, the disproportionate amount of workers who are considered essential who are of people of color, and the racial wealth gap. You know, all these things kind of play into that role. We need to have people who have those lived experiences working in our positions of power within planning agencies, within departments of transportation, both city, state, and even at the federal level, who can bring these discussions to the forefront and make them a consideration when building infrastructure, when or maintaining it, or and just having people with those with that mindset to help frame the decision-making process is very important. So I definitely want, that's something I know we've talked about in our work here at Urban. And I've heard, you know, especially now is becoming more of a topic of conversation. Is how many and agencies are talking about this. We need to hire more Black planners. We need to hire more Latinx planners. We need to hire more people of color in leadership positions. So when we do our planning, we are not going to just paper over the historical inequities that transportation has built, but to actually keep make those considerations. So when we do build equitably. We do build with access in mind, and we do build with inclusiveness in mind as well.
Yeah, and those are all very true. And I think again, there is a lot to unpack, and it keeps going because it comes down to who are decision makers listening to when planning and implementing projects. And so much of that comes down to who has political influence, which, again, is a whole other discussion in terms of disenfranchisement and the like. One thing, though, in the transportation building and planning and all that process particular that is, plays an important role for better or worse, depending, again, on a project-specific level, but is the kind of public input, the community meetings and all of that in terms of where you get thrown here's the project, now give comments. We talked about this right before we started recording. And, because of COVID, a lot of those have had to move online. Mm-hmm. And Richard, I would love to hear if you could talk, what has that meant for inclusiveness? Has that, obviously there are digital divide concerns in terms of if you only did Zoom meetings, not having internet and a computer and video or all that becomes an impediment. But on the flip side, has going online allowed more people to engage in the process and more voices to be heard?
Yeah, thank you for bringing it up, Pete. That's a very good question. It's interesting you say that because we at Urban actually did this study just recently where we interviewed 14 representatives from 11 different cities who work in chief technology technology offices or innovation offices, and asking this whole question about how does coronavirus impact your ability to provide services digitally to your residents? And of course, we saw that first the digital divide is wide as ever. We know that low cost expansion of low cost internet, interconnect devices, and little digital literacy training have all grown. And these are kind of been part of existing programs that a lot of cities have developed. And then, of course, there's this focus on young people as well. We're seeing even increases in ways that young people who are, of course, out of school, they can't go to their actual buildings, are now learning online. But there's that part as well, in terms of people, students who come from low income or neighborhoods with a large population of people of color are less likely to have broadband access, or if they do, it's at a degraded level compared to their white counterparts. So I think people are starting to see that it's very important that divide needs to be narrowed and even eliminated, so everybody can have access to broadband and therefore access to internet and access to information. And more to your point question, Pete, about the in community engagement, we're seeing what we've seen from some of the discussions we've had with these officers. Again, they're using Zoom more, or GoToMeeting, or some digital meeting platform much more often. They're doing more live streaming. They're doing more webinars, and it's actually in some cases expanding access for people to connect with their leaders. One great example I'd like to bring up is Aurora, Illinois, which is one of the cities that we interviewed. They just recently had a town hall on to update people on the coronavirus and or city council meeting, excuse me. And typically they bring in about 50 people for these when they have in-person meetings. When he went to a digital platform, they had 2,000 people engaged at one time in these meetings. And over the course of the meeting, like, you know, they had over 9,000 people who were going to be total who you're dialed in at one point in the meeting. So that access to digital platforms can help increase immensely the number of people who are able to engage with their residents. Another good example was just recently when they had in DC, they had a council meeting on police reform. And there was, you know, there, of course, they had the mayor and the police chief on the city council kind of talking about the, I think it was like $500 million budget for the MPD, which is the police department in DC. And the fact that they're able to get so many more people that they didn't have enough spots for people to share their thoughts. You know, they said they had 2,000 people who submitted comments, but only 90 people could submit because of time. That gives people who typically don't pay attention to these meetings or don't have access to these to engage their city leaders because of life situations, the ability to do so and share their grievances and concerns. And so, you're seeing a much larger level of engagement from people who want to have hear their voices heard. Thanks to this transition to digital communication. And people are now engaging their leaders much more so. I mean, it's a very bright spot. Now, you know, there's still a caveat where, as I mentioned earlier, there's still places where the broadband access is lacking, and cities in potential partnership with private, you know, entities and nonprofits working together through, you know, really innovative partnerships can help to build that infrastructure. And I think, you know, the pandemic has shown that it's even more important today. But in general, you're seeing, like, you know, when people have access to a smartphone, when people have access to a computer, either through their own ownership or even at the library, where a lot of people who don't have access to computers can go to, they are engaging, you know, their leaders in these meetings. They're engaging people through, you know, online calls and online meetings, and it allows more people to have a voice. So I think if we can focus on really narrowing that digital divide and narrowing the broadband, lack of broadband access, you're going to see a spike in community engagement. And I think that can only be a good thing for city leaders to make the right decisions.
And maybe more diversity in terms of opinion. Because I just, you know, what motivates if you take the time to review a project, you're like, oh, that's pretty good. That'd be pretty cool. And it's like, okay, nice. I need you to take 4 hours out of, like, right during dinner time and into your night. And there's going to be 6 of these meetings. And it's like, well, I mean, I think it'd be cool, but, like, if you're really against it or, you know, have, like, whatever, or you're just one of those people that loves to go to these meetings and fight things, that's the only voices you're going to hear. Whereas a more passive, like, hey, listen, I would love to stay informed. I like the project. I'm not willing to, like, you know, chain myself to the meeting, you know, front doors to get it. But, like, I would like it. I think I wouldn't be shocked if, you know, you talk to city DOTs in particular, and they would love to get more people like that into a meeting, because they're trying to, when they try to do good projects, they get a lot of pushback just from the, you know, the only people there are the ones saying no.
Right. Yeah. And one thing I also want to mention is kind of this, we talk about access to broadband. We also talk about access to data and understanding it. As part of the work that we're doing with Urban, we had a week long online forum the first week of June. And one of the sessions was focused on community engagement, which I moderated. And one of our panelists, was Noel Hidalgo who's the CEO of Beta NYC or New York City, of course. And basically his organization focuses on, connecting people to the data that the city puts out and actually understanding it and pushing for change. So one example that they did is that they were able to push for a health portal, coronavirus health portal, that the city puts out in terms of tracking where positive cases have popped up. You know, what is the status of the ICU beds and their hospital's capacity and to bringing coronavirus patients and also, you know, who have gotten sick and who have passed away from it. So this data was, you know, wasn't being published by New York City. And now this organization pushed for them to do that. And so they're able to get these numbers. In addition to that, they're training people on how to interpret data and how to interpret, you know, what they're seeing. So if you kind of can expand that to people now who maybe haven't had access to this, to community engagement meetings due to their lifestyles, they're not only are getting access to that, but because we are, there's a push to really expand the digital, to narrow the digital divide, they also are getting an understanding of the data and what informs the decisions. So there's a engagement piece, but there's also an education piece as well, that if you can put those two together, you can really have informed citizens on both sides of the aisle when it comes to a project or a question that's being contemplated by our government leaders, can provide irrelevant and impactful insight that can affect the decision. So I think that's a really, also a very, positive impact of the going increasingly digital in the world.
I love that because, you know, I think this is the, as we've talked about, has been a perennial problem with local decision making, right? It's that sometimes it ends up being a privilege to be able to go to meetings because of the times they're held, or because they're downtown. It's hard to access and get the transportation. I really do have the hope that, you know, this does lead us to look at how we can be more inclusive, more voices, and it's not just the person who has the luxury of spending 3 hours at a public meeting or going to it and leaving behind children or loved ones that they're caring for, and instead, you know, it's encouraging equitable policymaking through inclusion in these decisions.
Exactly. Yeah, the good thing that's happening right now is, you know, I think I don't want people to think that it's only the city council meetings that happen, you know, once a week or every other week or once a month that people are going to. I mean, I do want to give a shout out to, you know, all the planners out there, you know, Richard, you know, that are really thinking outside the box, that are working long hours, doing charrettes. I think we're right. Innovation offers this new opportunity to hopefully make public engagement cool and more enticing to more people. I just think of, you know, working from home, a lot of people were adamant about not doing it, and now people are starting to realize some of the conveniences that come from it. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully we can build off of that on the innovation side, but still making sure that once we do get past the, you know, pandemic, that people are still engaging in person, going to these things, going to charrettes, really being involved with the commenting process, engaging with staff, engaging with elected officials. Mm-hmm. 'Cause that's where I see a huge opportunity, is to make sure, you know, we're educating elected officials and giving them that political will that we talked about on, you know, a couple of the episodes too, of how do we bring about that change that we're talking about on a lot of our conversations, and that, you know, Richard, you're doing a good job of, you know, framing for us of how do we get some momentum behind this and make it a reality.
Exactly. Yeah. I 100% agree with that, Greg. And, you know, how we engage our community, how we bring people into the conversation, is going to be a transformation, but it's going to incorporate some of the old in and new, the in-person, but also the digital, and kind of, I think agencies and organizations, that are able to kind of mix those in a way that maximizes, people's voices being heard and results in actual decisions, taking those considerations into account, is going to be the strongest way moving forward. And because, you know, surveys have shown that there's such low trust in our government right now, I think those types of engagements and that strategic level of thinking could help really rebuild that trust and have people have more confidence in their government to help them make the right decisions, because they're now being heard and their thoughts are being taken into account. And they're ideally, you know, if it's like a transportation infrastructure project or some sort of a project that requires like multiple steps in planning, that those people are involved in the planning very early, and providing their input, not when things are already developed and, you know, here's what we're doing, but let's start from the beginning. And how do you, as a citizen, or a resident of this city, want to incorporate, your thoughts and your considerations into the development of a plan. So it's a true community engaged process with our government leaders and our planners and whoever, you know, we elect to, you know, serve our needs.
Right. And, you know, just to finish this point and we should move on, but, you know, we'd love to continue the conversation is, I mean, that's where I see the huge opportunity right now around innovation. And that was kind of the impetus of, you know, me playing devil's advocate now that I'm no longer a lawyer, I miss doing it, but, to really like push the envelope and to make sure that, you know, as we think about these new innovations, we're not just doing them because we think they'll work. We know that'll work. And that's why this conversation around community engagement is so important. Mm-hmm. You know, talking about the education on both, not just citizens, as we talk about, you know, new initiatives at ANITSA, talking about educating people around the capabilities of AVs, but how do we translate that into more public comments around potential use cases, talk about mm-hmm. right sizing. Mm-hmm. And then kind of, you know, a final point, and I love to hear your thought about this is, you know, another point I was trying to get at is how do we educate and get transportation to rise to the right political level and outside of just the local sphere and rise more into the, you know, conversations that are going to be happening at the presidential level? Because in my mind, I mean, I see transportation as, you know, the ultimate equalizer. I mean, you started off talking about how access to safe, reliable, and convenient transportation is what we dream of in all our communities, for everyone to have that opportunity. So, you know, as we approach the presidential election and, you know, do you see that conversation maybe elevating to that level? Or do you think, you know, we're still stuck at the local level?
I think as we get closer to the election, put out their platforms, transportation infrastructure is going to be one of the most, you know, I would say consequential, you know, plans moving forward, and will be a big factor in who gets elected, right? It's going to be like, what are your infrastructure development plans? Because we know that, you know, building and maintaining infrastructure could bring a lot of jobs. And also, as we transition to this post-coronavirus world, whenever that may be, and also kind of reckon with our long history of systemic racism, like transportation and infrastructure are all kind of intertwined in that. You know, we take for granted the fact that some of us can easily get from one place to another without any difficulty, where others do not. And if we really want to move forward as a country, tackling that question of, you know, the inequities that are inherent in people's movement is going to be a key concern, right? You know, I think that you've already seen a lot of buzz around the latest House transportation, the HR2, which is the House Democrats bill on transportation infrastructure, talking about, you know, new ways to measure road projects, ideas to bring new funding to infrastructure, so, you know, agencies can maintain their infrastructure more, measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions as climate is a more important part, is a key part of the transportation and infrastructure development over the next 5 years. So you're seeing a lot of these questions start to pop up. And I think as we get closer to election, it's going to be a major discussion point. Because it intersects so many factors, you know, health, cool. Our wealth, our education.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
I'd like to turn to the report that you had written previously when you were in your previous role at Union Concerned Scientists on autonomous vehicles, mm-hmm. And their deployment and equity. Could you talk us sort of through that report and what some of your findings were? Because I thought it was very interesting and had a very sort of local focus.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, thanks for asking that, Greg. So as I mentioned earlier in my introduction, I worked at UCS from 2017 to 2019. As a mobility equity fellow, and focused on looking at the impact of self-driving cars in DC metropolitan area. So a little bit of background behind that work is we wanted to look at if you have a fully autonomous vehicle fleet in the DC area, how that would specifically affect congestion, transit access and environmental emissions. So what we did is we took the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments, which is the COG here in the DC area, and it has a model that looks at how traffic is going to change over the next 20 to 30 years. We basically took their model, we took their baseline model, which was their long-term 2040. We compared it to the current time where we did the report, which is 2017. And then we incorporated two factors. One, we wanted to see if we encouraged pooling, so carpooling. So instead of having, a certain percentage of cars be single occupancy, we have a certain percentage of cars have two passengers, and how that would affect, the factors I mentioned. And then secondly, we also expanded transit. So we actually increased the access to transit, and the number of trains and buses that, ran in our metropolitan area. And we did that, and then we did analysis, and we ran those assumptions in the model that MCOG provides, and then again looked at congested vehicle miles traveled, transit miles traveled, and also access to jobs via a 45-minute commute. And we saw that in our work that basically if we let the status quo, you're going to see significant increases in vehicle miles traveled because autonomous vehicles, you can fit more in a certain, length of roadway. But, when you incorporate pooling, you see, you still see the increase, but it's not as pronounced as if you continue with the, one person per car, paradigm. And so that, of course, encourage people that if we do develop a network for autonomous vehicles, that you don't want to continue on with the status quo because it's going to increase congestion significantly. And then we showed that because, even though you have a fully autonomous vehicle fleet, it's only one part of the transportation system, and that you need to continue to support, our alternative modes such as public transit. And we saw that once we do that, we also saw increases in ridership as well. And then the other unique part of the work is that we focused on what the COG calls equity emphasis areas. These are census tracts that are defined by the COG as areas that have high populations of low income. I believe the definition was 150% below the poverty line. And then minority people of color communities, specifically the three they focus on is African American, Asian American, and Latinx. And we focused on, okay, when we run this model, how does congestion, emissions, and transit access affect people in those communities? And we saw that in many cases, even with the multi-passenger rides and maximizing transit, we still see increases in congestion, particularly in these equity emphasis areas compared to other census tracts that don't fit the definition. So like I said, basically in summary, we see a lot of driving increases via AVs. Encouraging pooling does help mitigate the increase, but you still see like a general increase. I think it's like with pooling, it's like 33%. When you don't have it, it's like 66% compared to 2040, and with 2040 being 2040 baseline, just status quo without AVs. And that of course showed us that, in addition to pooling, again, to minimize the increase in traffic, to support transit, to maximize people who ride transit, and then also to encourage electrification of vehicles as well to, mm-hmm. Mitigate or try to eliminate any increases in climate emissions that are generated from a influx of autonomous vehicles. So really pushing away from internal combustion engine powered AVs and going to electric AVs. And then, as I mentioned, really looking at these equity emphasis areas and understanding how this potential transition to a self-driving fleet is going to affect their quality of life. We published that report in February of 2019. We got some some interest in the Washington Post and other news media outlets, and also Greater Washington, who did some analysis on their own and work with AECOM to help the city to help do analysis for the DC government about, again, how would certain factors be affected by going to a fully autonomous fleet. So, and then at the end, kind of at the end, we also had a convening where we brought in people from, you know, workers represented in senior citizens, the disability communities, people who advocate for low income and people of color, and transportation agencies, other nonprofits who work in the space, and had this overall broad discussion about, you know, what does the AV future look like and how do we make equity a key consideration when moving to an autonomous vehicle fleet. So, that report really got a lot of traction. It was great work to be involved in. I learned so much about self-driving cars and their behavior and how planning for long-term planning works. And I do hope that, you know, that report, will continue to provide contribute to the conversation about what our self-driving car future in America looks like.
Great. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the big questions that, that we really need to be focused on is how do we ensure that autonomy, really fulfills its promises, to help to serve, as an equalizer, as it's been presented, and, really do appreciate, your work and in your focus, in that area. And I guess, on the note of technology, just a more broad question. I mean, as you look towards the future, what sort of transportation innovations, which we've been exploring a lot of these, you know, what are you excited about, new or old, that we're going to see, and how do you see new technologies actually helping us to solve some of these problems, and how can we do that?
Yeah, I think that a couple of things come to mind. First, I feel strongly about public transit. For whatever people may say, coronavirus is going to knock that down. I still think that it has a place in the way we move around in our environment. And I do think that agencies are thinking innovatively. They are starting to think outside the box. They know that they are living in a different time, during Corona and post Corona, that will require them to be flexible, in terms of rebuilding their ridership and, getting people to where they need to go. I also think that, especially in this current time of, addressing systemic racism, they're also going to be at the forefront and thinking about, again, how to maximize access for all people. I'd love to see, some form of expansion, whether it's, increased bus routes to, serve more people to, again, minimize the number of people that are on one bus, so you have more opportunities to get to where you need to go. Maybe this intersection of the intersection of transit and microtransit to help fill that first mile, last mile gap, I think is going to get some interest in as well. And I'm really excited again about new mobility. I wonder, with that question, we're seeing a lot of closures from scooter companies and consolidations, but I think they believe there's going to be a point where there's going to be some stabilization in the sector, and you're going to start seeing less, you're going to start hearing less about profitability and capital of these companies, and then you're going to hear more about integration into overall transportation systems. And then secondly, there's been a lot of discussion about the integration of multiple modes into one app, and not just one app, but one ability to pay. You're seeing a lot of this already in Europe, Switzerland. You can, with one app, you can basically pay for a trip using multiple modes anywhere across the country. There are some other third-party apps that are trying to implement this in other countries in Europe and in Asia. You're seeing some pushes on that front here in the United States, particularly in New York City with their Omni, Portland, and San Francisco. They're trying to integrate all modes into one app or one card that can allow you to take multiple trips, public transit, Uber, Lyft, taxi, scooter, bike, all with like one payment. And that this kind of integrated mode is something that I've thought about a lot. And I think could be a game changer when it comes to moving around. If you can, instead of having to pay with three or four different ways, you have one way of doing that, one way to do it, just one payment, and you can go anywhere without a car using multiple modes, I think is exciting. And in a caveat of that, you know, we need to make sure that because a lot of people, especially from low income and neighborhoods of people of color, don't have smartphones or even a bank account, that we need to keep these people in consideration. And, you know, there's some number of ways that they're doing that. But if there is this kind of push to this upgrade in the way we pay for transportation, bring those people or, you know, connect them to the banking system or find an alternative ways to allow them to pay with prepaid cards or with cash is something that we need to consider as well. But yeah, I really think that this integration of multiple modes is going to be a game changer and something that's going to, you know, have to happen if we're going to still have a very robust transportation system that everybody can use in a cost efficient and effective way. So that's what I'm excited about.
Awesome. Yeah. And I totally agree in that, you know, we don't want to see a world where the digital divide exacerbates the issues in the transportation divide and, you know, vice versa. Right. And you know, that's going to have to be something that, that we're focused on, with an eye towards equity. As we have up here, Richard is, so, I guess one final exercise, let's say that you have a magic mobility wand. We're going to trademark this under the Mobility Podcast. What would you change in our transportation sector? If there's one thing, what would it be? And I suppose why?
Mass mobility wand. And if I could change one thing in transportation sector, what would that be? So many things to change. I would say, you know what? I do know. The one thing that I would change or find a way to incorporate. And some people are doing this now, but I want to see more widespread and more codified and connected to some metrics is how do we define equity in our planning policy, right? How do we ensure that projects are being scored or built that there are specific indicators of equity that are integral and required for a project to move forward. You know, I mean, you have like, for example, with the American Disabilities Act, you know, you have to have a certain level of accommodation for people who have some sort of disability. They have to be able to use the system and just as any normal user can use it. So for those communities, people who are typically left out of the transportation system or have an enhanced difficulty compared to your regular user, you know, how do we make that equity and whatever that means, you know, access to jobs or access to parks and other amenities, or does it mean, you know, trying to equalize travel times or, you know, minimize parking, things like that, that, you know, have some sort of equity component, codifying that into our procurement and our product development platforms. So it becomes front and center in any development. I would love to see that happen. I don't think that happens enough when we design our projects, especially since a lot of the funding for a lot of transportation infrastructure is at the state level, and that's not usually one of the concerns. You know, they don't see the local, you know, issues when it comes to equitable access. If we can put that in, codify that into our planning, and metrics when evaluating projects. And then, of course, bringing in the cities, local municipalities, and regional governments to be able to have decision-making power as well. Kind of a side note, House Democrats' transportation infrastructure bill, they actually do provide some money for metropolitan planning organizations to have a say in, you know, developing projects, which is a big change from the past. But I think if you can have that equity piece, a required component of project development and the project moving forward, and having people who have, in the space who can understand what that's important, that's what I would like to see. You know, kind of, I would say standardizing and operationalizing equity is what I would say it into planning and project development.
I love that, and could not agree more. Richard, and as we wrap up, if folks want to follow your work, where can they find you online? Mm-hmm. Of course, we'll have you on again soon. But how can folks track you in the meantime?
Thank you for that, Greg. So people can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at my call name, Dr. DrRCEZIKE. So that's Dr. RCEZIKE. Of course, you can search for me on urban.org's website and learn a little bit more about the work that I'm doing here at the Urban Institute. Of course, my LinkedIn as well. If you just search for Richard Ezeki, you can easily find me. And definitely, I'm always open to reaching out and connecting with people who have an interest in this work, who are looking to talk about transportation and infrastructure, and particularly with the focus on ensuring that transportation is accessible, cost-effective, and equitable for all people, because it's the backbone of our society. It allows us to gain economic mobility and other levels of mobility, and is a great equalizer. And so I'm hoping that, you know, if you are interested in this work, please reach out, and I'd love to discuss your ideas and your thoughts on this space and how we can really, again, use transportation to promote a better society as a whole.
Awesome. Thank you. And we will put links to all of those in the show notes for anyone who's listening. And Pete, Greg, where do you find you guys online?
You can find me, check out our website at catapult-strategies.com and on Twitter at catapultpolicy.
And currently you can find me self-quarantining at home, but online at Smarter Transfo.
Awesome. Awesome. And I am at AV Greg R. Mobility Podcast is on Twitter, of course, at Mobility Podcast, and website is mobilitypodcast.com. So be sure to head over and check them out. Well, Richard, thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to having you on again soon, and take care, and look forward to chatting with everyone very, very soon. We have a lot of new episodes coming out soon.
Hang in there, everybody. Be smart. Yeah. Wear a mask.
Agreed. Thank you. Yeah, let me bring that
Thanks,
up.
Richard.
Yeah, thank you guys. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all.